From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Belgium is on heightened alert after an anti-terror raid. The U.S. Secretary of State visits terror attack sites in France. An analyst calls the terrorist attacks an assault on Islam.
We must not let the murderers hijack and claim Islam for themselves, because it's not theirs and it's something that belongs to the 1.6 billion people around the world who are Muslims.
And police take a non-traditional role of youth educator to deter crime. I'm Susan Yawkey. Belgium and other Western countries are on a heightened alert following a police operation Thursday in Belgium against a suspected terrorist cell. Two suspected terrorists were killed and one was seriously wounded in the city of Verviers. Police cell itself was made up of fighters who have recently returned from Syria. Zlatica Hoek reports for VOA Television.
Belgian authorities say that police raids, about 10 of them, have foiled terrorist attacks on police buildings. A spokesman for the federal prosecutors said some of the members of the targeted group had been to Syria, where a Western coalition is bombarding strongholds of the terrorist group Islamic State.
L'enquête a permis de déterminer que ce groupe était sur le point de commettre des attentats.
The investigation was able to establish that this group was about to commit terrorist acts on a grand scale in Belgium and imminently. During the intervention, the suspects immediately and for several minutes opened fire with military weaponry and handguns on special forces of the federal police before being neutralized. Two suspects were killed, and a third was intercepted at the scene. No witnesses or police were hurt during the intervention.
Verviers is a former industrial town with a large immigrant population. It is about 125 kilometers southeast of the capital, Brussels. An eyewitness described the swift action near the Verviers train station.
I saw a black car arrive and armed policemen came out. They blocked the street and ran into the building. Everything happened so fast. I had no idea what was going on, but I heard shooting.
A local police chief said it was a federal police operation and that his forces did not participate.
The operation was quite destructive, both in terms of human loss and material loss.
The mayor of Verviers praised the way the operation was handled.
I can only deplore what they were planning, but above all, we should praise the quality of the firepower of our federal police. They were successful in a very good operation, trying to stop these people, two of whom are dead. It's important to underline the quality of their work. We have avoided a major drama here today.
The Belgian anti-terror operation took place days after suspected Islamist militants killed 17 people in two separate attacks in Paris. Those attacks have not been linked with the raid in Belgium. Thousands of foreign fighters have joined the Islamic State in Syria. Many of them are returning to their home countries after the U.S. and Western coalition air raids destroyed some of the group's strongholds in Iraq and Syria. Security agencies say they now pose a threat at home. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has visited the sites of Islamic extremist attacks in France last week that left 17 people dead. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is traveling with the U.S. official.
On an overcast day here in Paris, Secretary of State John Kerry has visited the sites of three makeshift memorials to the victims of last week's Charlie Hebdo shootings. At one site, he paused and bowed his head in an apparent prayer. At another site, located near the office of the Charlie Hebdo publication, he paused to read names that were left on sheets of paper on a wall in tribute to the victims. There he also laid a wreath. At the locations, Kerry was joined by French officials, including President Hollande and Foreign Minister Fabius.
Police in Paris say have detained at least 10 people suspected of having ties to the shooters. Authorities are on high alert for further attacks. The Islamic terrorist attacks in France and other Muslim-linked terrorist attacks have brought scorn from other segments of society around the world, but also from the Muslim community. Ed Hussein, a Muslim senior advisor at the Tony Blair Faith Foundation, has written an article titled, "Charlie Hebdo, We Cannot Let the Paris Murderers Define Islam." We asked him what he means.
The Paris murderers can't define Islam because in the minds of the vast majority of the people of the world, the headlines, the media headlines, are dominated by extremists, murderers, beheaders, terrorists, and others. And for, sadly, many people, that is what Islam seems to represent today, and it mustn't, because one in four people around the world are Muslim, and their religion, my religion, very precious to us, ought not to be defined by the evil that's being unleashed in the name of this religion. So my argument is that, yes, Charlie Hebdo and the killings were wrong, and we shouldn't forgive the murderers, but at the same time, we must not let the murderers hijack and claim Islam for themselves, because it's not theirs, and it's something that belongs to the 1.6 billion people around the world who are Muslims, and for us it's very precious and something that we treasure, and it mustn't be defined by the actions of the evil individuals.
And in your article, you actually say that the French attacks were an assault on Islam.
The French attacks were indeed an assault on Islam, and I say so because Muslims and Islam were not present in the West, in France, for the last 1,400 years. It then begs the question, well, why do we have 5 million Muslims in France, 30 million Muslims around the West today? It's because the West has institutional guarantees, freedoms, laws in place to allow Muslims like myself to practice our faith and live freely. To attack those very freedoms that allow us to prosper is to attack us, is to attack our way of life, is to then undermine the freedom that Islam and Muslims enjoy. So it's in many ways a hit or setting the very fire that we're trying to put out onto the House of Islam itself.
The attacks on this political magazine and the terrible tragedy there in their offices, it has raised the issue of freedom of speech and how to define freedom of speech, and should we really have so much freedom? What is your definition of freedom of speech through the eyes of a member of the Islam community?
That people are free to say whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want, but with some degree of restraint and wisdom in a given circumstance. It's the old test of not crying fire in a packed cinema or a packed theater. And knowing that, and incidentally, the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists were right to publish whatever it is they wanted. It's wrong of Muslims then to respond in the way that extremist Muslims have. Now that we're in a situation that we know that this provocation is going to lead to, God forbid, something worse than the Danish cartoons or what happened in Paris, I think the British media and the American media have exercised the right levels of wisdom and restraint in trying not to put further fuel on this fire, but allow for maturity, debate, and growth and education to materialize among the extremist fringe that wishes to silence the majority of us.
What is your reaction to the magazine's decision to put another cartoon of Muhammad on the front cover?
It's a real concern that it's being irresponsible, it's adding fuel to a fire at a time when some restraint ought to be exercised in order to let this period flow. And I say so because after the Danish cartoon controversy, we've seen now a greater acceptance of freedom of speech among Muslims. And when the Danish cartoons happened, I mean, I found it hard to stomach and to accept that level of insult on someone that we consider so dear, the Prophet Muhammad. But now, you know, 5 years on, I think millions of Muslims around the world are in a different mental space, as in, you know, live and let live. So after these kind of shock incidents, we need to let some time go by before Charlie Hebdo decides to go on another freedom of speech crusade. It's important that they continue to uphold their freedoms, but I think it's just worthwhile giving space for some growth and enlightenment and education to spread.
Ed Hussein, a senior advisor at the Tony Blair Faith Foundation and author of the article, Charlie Hebdo, We Cannot Let the Paris Murderers Define Islam. The United States is planning to deploy more than 400 troops to train moderate Syrian rebels to fight the Islamic State group. The training is expected to begin in March. The Defense One website says Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia have agreed to host the training sessions. The U.S. has not yet identified where it will draw its forces from for the training mission. The training program is part of President Barack Obama's multi-year plan to field local forces in Syria to halt and eventually roll back Islamic State fighters while pounding them with U.S.-led airstrikes. Recent opinion polls are showing a larger percentage of Americans favoring at least limited military operations against the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. These polls also indicate public openness to expanding and escalating these operations if necessary. The findings suggest a turnaround in public attitudes after years of war weariness during America's involvement in conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. University of Maryland and Brookings Institution scholar Shelby Talami conducted some of the research, and VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy asked about his findings.
This is really interesting because, you know, when you look at all the issues that the American public has been focused on, and as you recall, in the past year, we've had two issues that have been in the public eye, particularly the Iran issue with all the looming deadlines for the nuclear issue, and the Israel-Palestine question, which obviously in the summer faced an episode of a lot of violence that had, you know, generated attention in the U.S. So the fact that they say ISIS is the number one threat, and 70% of them say that, and only 12% say Iran and 13% say Israel-Palestine, is really surprising. And I know that a lot of people have gone for the easy answer, the beheadings. But I think there's a problem with that explanation, in part because when you think about the beheadings, first you think about the ugly ruthlessness. Obviously, these are abhorrent events that, you know, turned a lot of people against ISIS all over the world. But frankly, even when President Obama told the American public that Assad used chemical weapons against his people, they still didn't want to attack his forces. And if you say it's because some of those beheaded were American, well, that can also take you in another direction. In fact, we've seen that in the past. Back in 1990, when American bodies of American soldiers were dragged in the streets of Somalia, this was said to have turned the American public against intervention, not for intervention. So it really needed exploration. And what we find in the poll is actually the principal reason why those who want to intervene more forcefully, including use ground forces, want to do so, is that they think that ISIS is just an extension of Al-Qaeda. That's the number one answer. The people think that there isn't much of a difference, that this is just a reincarnation of an organization they thought had been on the defensive, and suddenly it's rising in a way that concerns them, and they see it as unfinished business. Ruthlessness of ISIS is also a factor. It's really the number two factor, but it's interesting that it's not so much any potential threat to the American homeland or a threat to allies that is really pushing the public to want to say we need to intervene.
Did that ranking reflect a great support among Americans to put boots on the ground against ISIL if airstrikes fail to stop that terrorist group?
This is an interesting question, and we've been exploring it for a while. It's still a majority of Americans don't want to send ground forces. We have 57% of Americans overall that say we don't want ground forces, even if the airstrikes fail down the road. And my suspicion is it would be higher if, in fact, the decision is made to do so. The interesting thing, though, is that there is a really big difference across party lines. There is a huge opposition to sending ground forces among Democrats and independents, only 31% of independents and 36% of Democrats would support under such circumstances the possibility of sending ground forces if airstrikes fail. But among Republicans, you have 53% who are open to it and 46% who oppose it. Now, yes, that's a majority, slight majority, but Republicans remain divided because the fact is 46% say even if airstrikes fail, they clearly would oppose it. And that, you know, does tell you that the Republicans will probably be facing an interesting debate in the primaries, particularly among those who want to intervene more forcefully and those who don't.
University of Maryland and Brookings Institution scholar Shelby Talami. We plan on bringing you more of his remarks Monday on International Edition.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
No matter how hard they try or how many of them there are, the police cannot be everywhere. So some deputies with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department are looking for new ways to keep people safe in historically dangerous neighborhoods. In our new series, To Protect and to Serve, Elizabeth Lee reports on how some police are becoming teachers and mentors in hopes of making everyone safer.
At 14 years old, Brian Fuentes has experienced firsthand what many Americans only see on TV.
You're exposed to drugs, you're exposed to gang violence, you're exposed to homicides, you're exposed to all sorts of dangers.
Fuentes is from South Los Angeles, an area plagued by poverty and crime.
7, 8, 9, 10.
But there is a safe haven here in an old police station that's been turned into an after-school youth center for students. It's called a Youth Activities League and is the result of a partnership between law enforcement and the nonprofit group Sheriff's Youth Foundation. Whether it's schoolwork, a game of basketball, or advice, students can get help there from staff, volunteers, and deputies from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. 17-year-old Andrea Duran used to distrust law enforcement.
I used to think they were just bad, the bad guys, catching the bad guys.
But that negative image of law enforcement quickly changed when Duran started coming to the Youth Activities League and got to know the deputies personally.
They can feel like family. That's what they are to me now.
I'm going to come to day 1, 2, 3.
This type of non-traditional policing helps break down preconceived stereotypes. Among many immigrants, that means showing them police in the U.S. are different from law enforcement in their home countries, says Deputy Alma Gonzalez, whose parents are immigrants.
In Mexico, unfortunately, you do hear a lot of corruption. There is a lot of corruption. And then coming to this country, whatever contact they had had with the law enforcement, it wasn't very positive because of either immigration or the uniform. It's intimidating.
Working with the youth is one way to change that perception, says Los Angeles County Sheriff Jim McDonald.
Getting to a family through their children allows us to be able to have an opportunity to really take our relationships to another level.
Now we're taking away what's left.
McDonald says community outreach is one reason why violent crimes have been decreasing countywide. But gangs and crime still exist here, and having places like the Youth Activities League in urban neighborhoods throughout the county gives young people another option, says Deputy Bruce McCall.
I try and do things to educate youth and encourage youth and expose youth to new and exciting things that they don't limit themselves to what may be going on in their community.
Most students who attend this after-school program for at least 6 months have improved self-esteem and are more confident in school. Brian Fuentes says he wants to go to college and pursue a career in law enforcement so he too can help those in need. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
The U.S. Treasury Department says new rules for U.S. citizens traveling to Cuba will start to be implemented today as part of President Barack Obama's efforts to normalize relations with the communist country. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew said in a statement Thursday that the move takes the United States one step closer to replacing out-of-date policies that were not working. He also said the changes will have a direct impact on further engaging and empowering the Cuban people, promoting positive change for Cuba's citizens. The new rules will eliminate the need for a license for U.S. citizens who travel to Cuba for any of a dozen approved reasons. General tourism will remain banned. Washington attorney Robert Muse, an expert on U.S. law related to Cuba, told VOA that hefty fines will continue to be imposed on those involved in unauthorized travel. Travel agents and airlines will be allowed to provide authorized services without a license. The U.S.-based air carrier United Airlines says that it plans to offer flights to Cuba from Houston, Texas, and Newark. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 16, 1707, the Scottish Parliament gave final ratification to the Act of Union, paving the way for the creation of Great Britain. In 1979, in the face of a deteriorating economy, an army mutiny, and violent demonstrations against his rule, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi left Iran, saying he was going on vacation. He would never return. With the Iranian government in disarray, the Ayatollah Khomeini returned from a 15-year exile in France to direct a revolution, resulting in a new theocratic republic guided by Islamic principles. On this day in 1991, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater announced the start of Operation Desert Storm.
The liberation of Kuwait has begun. In conjunction with the forces of our coalition partners, the United States has moved under the code name Operation Desert Storm to enforce the mandates of the United Nations Security Council.
The air war gave way 5 weeks later to a ground assault that quickly chased Iraqi troops out of Kuwait. On this day in 1932, jazz great Duke Ellington and his orchestra recorded It Don't Mean a Thing. With vocals by Ivy Anderson, the song marked a shift in the fashionable style from the hot jazz of the 1920s to the swing music of the 1930s. The song went on to define the era and became one of Duke Ellington's biggest and most successful hits. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent visit to Pakistan, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry emphasized the importance of U.S.-Pakistan cooperation in the fight against terrorism. Among Pakistan's civilian and military leadership, said Secretary Kerry, there is a strong consensus about the importance of combating all forms of terrorism. Terror groups like the Pakistani and Afghan Taliban, the Haqqani Network, Lashkar-e-Taiba, and other groups continue to pose a threat to Pakistan, to its neighbors, and to the United States. All of us, said Secretary Kerry, have a responsibility to ensure that these groups do not gain a foothold, but rather are pushed back into the recesses of Pakistan memory. This task is obviously far from finished, he said. Just as we stand with the people of France at this difficult hour, said Secretary Kerry, America will continue to stand with the people of Pakistan as they build a future that is free from the threat of violent extremism. The United States continues to expand its ties with Pakistan across a broad range of issues, including trade. In May 2014, both countries concluded an MOU on promoting women's economic empowerment. Annual two-way trade with Pakistan has already reached more than $5 billion, and there is room to grow. To find further opportunities, the two countries are organizing the U.S.-Pakistan Economic Partnership Week in Islamabad in March. For the last 5 years, the U.S. has worked with Pakistan to improve electricity delivery, which has resulted in adding 1,400 megawatts to the power grid in Pakistan. That's enough electricity for more than 16 million Pakistani citizens. The U.S. is supporting new transmission and renewable energy projects. In addition, the U.S. has partnered with Pakistan on infrastructure investments. The U.S. funded the construction and rehabilitation of more than 1,000 kilometers of roads, including the four main trade routes to Afghanistan. The U.S. is also working with Pakistan to promote regional cooperation on counterterrorism and trade. The U.S. welcomes the renewed cooperation between Pakistan and Afghanistan to address the region's most important issues. A strong U.S.-Pakistan partnership is key to overcoming the toughest problems, including the terrorist threat. It is vital, said Secretary Kerry, that we do not underestimate what can be accomplished by building trust, expanding ties, and acting together in common purpose.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.